Hello and welcome to New Books in Terrorism and Organised Crime. I'm your host, Mark Locks. Today we're going to be talking to Paul Rexton Khan about his new book, Cartels at War, Mexico's Drug-Fueled Violence and the Threat to U.S. National Security. This is a quite amazingly good book. It's very short but packed full of information. Mr. Khan covers everything from the background of how the drug war began, how it's laid out, the groups involved, how it affects other governments, what government responses are, and then also gives some excellent recommendations on what, if anything, can be done about this program. So I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I hope you enjoy the interview. Okay, welcome to another episode of New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime. I'm your host, Mark Locks, and today we're talking to Paul Rexton Khan about his excellent new book, Cartels at War, Mexico's Drug-Fueled Violence and the Threat to U.S. National Security. Hi, Paul. How are you going?
Hi. Good, Mark. Good to talk to you.
That's good. And you're in Washington, is that correct, right now?
No, I'm in Carlisle, Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay, Pennsylvania, right. Sorry, Army War College. I'm just making assumptions there about where it's located.
Oh, that's right.
Yep. And thank you for having the interview today about your book. I really enjoyed the book. As I was saying to you in the pre-interview, I learned so much. My full knowledge of this area was coming from watching CNN and getting a minuscule percentage of the information that's actually involved in what's going on in this particular issue. But we'll start off with just a bit of background about yourself and how you ended up in the career you've got and ended up writing this particular book.
Sure. Yeah. This is actually an offshoot of my first book, which is Drugs in Contemporary Warfare, which actually examined how various non-state actors, from insurgent groups to terrorists, are actually, involved in the drug trade at some level, either to finance their activities or they will ingest drugs themselves to fight conventional forces. And my publisher a couple of years back said, have you thought about writing anything about what's going on in Mexico? And I thought, well, I think that subject is pretty well covered. But as I did some more digging around, what I did notice was that a lot of the books that had been written were mostly journalistic accounts of people who basically said, yeah, I've been to Mexico, it's really scary. Or very alarmist books that said that Mexico was going to collapse. So what I decided to do was to actually kind of take the flip side of my first book, which is actually this book, looking at how a lot of these organized crime groups in Mexico are actually adapting their tactics to mimic what is insurgent or terrorist violence.
Right, right. And you do so in a lot of detail. I'll repeat again what I was saying to you in the pre-interview, that when you pick this book up, it doesn't look very long, but you are very, very concise in your writing style. So there's a tremendous amount of information in what appears to be a quite short book. So having said that, we might jump straight in and start talking about it too. You want to give us just a bit of a background to how this whole issue began in Mexico in particular? I think everyone knows a lot about Colombia and things like that, but Mexico is fairly recent.
Yeah, it is. It really started in the 1990s with the North American Free Trade Agreement between Canada, the United States, and Mexico, which opened up our borders to free access and free movement of goods and services. So what that did is that actually broke down one of the barriers that allowed kind of illicit goods to piggyback, if you will, onto licit goods and to travel more freely. And as you mentioned, Colombian cocaine was also influential in that the United States in particular was getting very good at interdicting Colombian cocaine coming via the Caribbean. And with the opening of overland borders because of NAFTA, the Colombian cartels decided, there's this new entryway now through Mexico. Why don't we get involved with some of the Mexican drug traffickers who have always been smuggling marijuana and some Mexican heroin into the U.S. Overland and use them as middlemen to get Colombian cocaine into the United States more easily rather than having to put up with the Caribbean route. So that was one of the early phenomena that actually led to the expansion of Mexican cartels' power and influence. And the other thing that occurred was in 2000 in Mexico, there was an election that swapped out a political party that had been in power for over 70 years. And so you had new arrangements that all of a sudden the cartels and the drug traffickers are trying to figure out, okay, well, who are really now the political bosses that we can corrupt, co-opt, and collude with in order to get this new product, Colombian cocaine, through to the United States, as well as our previous products of marijuana and Mexican heroin. So there was a kind of a free-for-all that occurred in the 1990s, early 2000s, and then in 2006, there was another presidential election in Mexico, and that president, Felipe Calderon, decided that he was going to take a much more confrontational approach to the cartels and send in the military to take them on. And that's when the explosion really took off from 2006 until today, where since 2006, there have been over 60,000 Mexicans who have been killed, and about 30,000 Mexicans have disappeared. And as of last year, there's one drug-related homicide every half hour in Mexico. And there's also a sizable number of Mexicans who are now coming to the United States to seek asylum from criminal violence.
That's an amazing number of deaths.
Yeah, it's tremendous. It actually exceeds some low-intensity conflicts. For example, it exceeds the IRA in Northern Ireland over decades during the Troubles. It also exceeds the PKK in Turkey, the insurgent group there. I think there have only been around 30,000 deaths. Right now, the only conflict that is close to that is the conflict in Syria.
Which is a full-on war.
Right, which is a full-on war that's been, you know, which is now 2 years old, going into 3 years. But it is a staggering number of homicides in Mexico.
And who's actually being killed? Is it the actual participants themselves, the cartel operators, or is it collateral damage, or is it police?
Well, it's all of that. It's state agents like police and mayors, also journalists. The most dangerous country for journalists is actually Mexico. But it's also folks who are related to the drug gangs, who are enforcers for the cartels. It's also innocent people who go to discotheques or who are even going to drug rehabilitation centers. Also other illegal migrants who are passing through Mexico from other countries in Central America. The largest one-day massacre occurred 2 years ago in northern Mexico, and there were 70 migrants from Central America who were gunned down by the cartel Los Zetas because they refused to work for the gang and also refused to carry drugs into the United States with them. So it's a very target set, if you will, but it ranges from ordinary citizens going about their daily business, to migrants, to state agents, to other cartel and gang members.
Wow. Well, I suppose this is a good time then to move on. And if you can tell us exactly who these cartels are and how many they are and how they're spread out.
Yeah, there are actually about seven big cartels now, six or seven, depending on who you talk to. Rather than going through all seven, I'll pick out a couple of, or two or three, of the more exceptional ones. One of them is the Sinaloa cartel, which is run by one of the world's wealthiest men, El Chapo Guzman. El Chapo is slang for shorty. And he is actually sort of like a narco-venture capitalist. He's one of the most expansionist leaders of a cartel in drug trafficking history. As a matter of fact, in Australia, they caught a couple of members of the Sinaloa cartel not too long ago. So he's actually been moving product even to West Africa, so from Australia to West Africa.
Well, I'll just say that the reason why they're moving to Australia is the street price of cocaine in Australia is five times the street price in the USA.
Yeah, that's correct.
So there's a massive profit incentive there.
Yeah, it's one more market. And same with the West African market. The West Africa is a transit point for the European market. Particularly, on through Spain into the UK. So that profit margin is also larger than the U.S. profit margin. So it's another attempt to gain more profit. Another cartel is Los Zetas, which loosely translates as the Z's, the letter Z or Z. And this group is actually made up of former members of the Mexican Special Forces, who used to be enforcers for another cartel, the Gulf Cartel, until they broke away and started their own cartel in and of themselves. They're very proficient in the use of violence, very wanton, have a very martial spirit. They will carve their initials, the Z or the Z, into corpses to leave their mark, their criminal brand, if you will. And they were also responsible for that massacre of 70 migrants. They're very good at psychological warfare. They targeted journalists, state agents. And recently, and this is an article that I have coming up, they recently had a cyber spat or cyber skirmish with the hacktivist group Anonymous, where they actually tried to reverse hack members of Anonymous to figure out who they were and to intimidate them. Then there's another group called La Familia Michoacana, or La Familia, which split, and there's another group that split off from them called Los Caballeros Templarios, which is really the Knights Templar. And there's sort of this quasi-religious, almost born-again Christian cartel that started off as kind of a vigilante group, but began a series of beheadings in Mexico where they actually cut off 6 heads in a discotheque and threw them down the stairs and said this was divine justice for all those who opposed their will in their particular state. But they really, as I mentioned, started this campaign of beheadings where by 2008, there are more beheadings in Mexico than in Iraq and Afghanistan combined.
This is getting to a point where it's beyond movie scripts, where the characterization of these groups and what they're doing wouldn't be acceptable to a movie producer. They would laugh out of the room.
Well, yeah, that's right. And there have actually been, you know, a couple of cinematic attempts to capture just how wild a lot of this has become. I think there was recently an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie here. I can't remember. I think it's called The Last Stand.
Yes.
Or something like that, where it was, you know, this cartel member is actually moving back down towards Mexico. But there is, you know, a pantheon of narco saints, if you will, or these kind of quasi-mystical figures that a lot of traffickers will pray to in order to get protection from the authorities or to grant them safe passage as they smuggle their goods into the United States, or even to seek revenge upon another group. They will venerate these particular saints in order to gain protection or to get good standing within their particular community.
So are these saints dead former gang members, or are they, you know, living gods, so to speak?
Well, one of them is Jesus Malverde, which is an image crafted on a 1940s Mexican cinematic star. And another one is Santa Muerte, which is the Grim Reaper. And basically, these two narco saints are the ones that are venerated by these traffickers in order to gain protection, as I mentioned, for their particular missions. So they're not actually deceased members of the cartels, but a lot of cartel members and gang members will pray to these saints for the souls of those who have departed. So it's pretty wild stuff.
It's amazing. And you also point out in the book, there's some quite good maps about the range of influence. It's quite territorial.
Yes, that's right. I mean, what the war is really over is access into the United States, or plazas or routes into the U.S. So the 6 states of northern Mexico that run along the border of the southern United States, these are really the states that have had a lot of the homicides. For example, Ciudad Juarez, which was also nicknamed Murder City. That particular city, for the longest time, had a murder rate that was, you know, stratospheric. It was 1 homicide every 3 hours. And recently, the violence has come down, where so much so that the headline in the newspaper a few weeks ago was, no homicides over this past weekend. So, you know, celebrating something that didn't happen, if you will, which, you know, is somewhat amazing. But yeah, those 6 states are really prime territory. in that, again, they're the access point for drugs and for people, Mexicans seeking to come into the United States. There are other areas of Mexico that are ports where precursor chemicals for processing heroin or methamphetamine or access to Colombian cocaine, where Colombian cocaine actually enters Mexico bound for the United States. So those areas are also hotly contested, but not quite as violent as the northern states.
Right, right. So the choke points, so to speak, of entry, the ones that where the attention is.
Right. It's also what my friend Phil Williams calls strategic warehousing. This is where all, you know, all the drugs kind of go to be disarticulated and into smaller parcels in order to be smuggled. But these particular areas are where all the drugs kind of arrive into these warehouses, if you will, and then are kind of disaggregated for various deliveries into the United States.
Is there any fighting over the northern side of the border when the drugs are arriving again, where people are fighting to get access? Because obviously if you're entering from one side, you have to come out on the other side.
Right. You know, that's interesting. It's not as violent as Mexico, for sure, because it doesn't actually behoove the gang members and the cartel members to be as violent in the United States as they are in Mexico. In Mexico, only 5% of crimes are ever solved. Only 2% of crimes ever go to trial. A small fraction of those end up being, you know, a conviction of some sort, and then a smaller fragment of that means prison. Whereas in the United States, there isn't that culture of impunity, and that a lot of traffickers actually rely on the fact that it's more peaceful in the United States to conduct their operations. In fact, a lot of cartel members and drug gang leaders live in the United States and not in Mexico because it's actually safer for them to be in the United States than in Mexico. So
they're running away from their own violence.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, it's this sort of perversity that happens too, where in the U.S. we have ordinary Mexicans called invertanistas, or people who are inverted, where they will actually now live temporarily in the United States and commute down to Mexico during the day for their work and then come back to the U.S. at night, because it's just safer to be in the United States temporarily overnight than it is to be in Mexico. So you'll have mayors and police chiefs who actually live in the U.S. but run their towns via cell phone from the United States and will ever so occasionally go back into Mexico.
Wow. Just amazing. So let's talk about what effect this has all had on Mexico itself. Is Mexico turning, not maybe not into a failed state, but is it massively undermining civil operations in the country?
Well, you know what has happened is the steady erosion of Mexicans' belief in democracy and in democratic practices. That in a recent poll of Latin America, Mexicans have consistently rated democracy as not all that effective in their particular country, which is sad in a lot of respects, because Mexico is a democracy. But what you've had is also now a lot of kind of transition between political parties. So we've had an election in Mexico last year that has brought about the return of the former political party that was in power for 70 years and who had colluded with the drug traffickers. So a lot of Mexicans were hoping that, okay, if you return this particular political party to power, maybe they can cut the deal with the traffickers and just reduce the violence. That Mexicans are just so tired of violence that they're willing to sacrifice transparency and openness that a democracy needs just in order to have some relief when it comes to violence in their daily lives.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite astounding. But
yeah.
It's easy to say that from Australia, where nothing like this is actually happening.
Yeah.
Is it doing anything to the economy? I mean, you're talking about precursor chemicals are coming in. They've still got the marijuana crops, which I was surprised to see was, I think you said, was still the majority or the largest crop that's being moved across the border.
Right. Well, the Mexican drug economy is estimated to be about $39 billion American, which outstrips legitimate parts of the Mexican economy. For example, remittances from Mexicans living in the United States to Mexico is actually only around $18 billion, and the Mexican tourism economy is about $11 billion. However, the Mexican economy is growing because of manufacturing. A lot of U.S. companies are leaving the Chinese market because the Chinese market wages are rising in China. So American companies are trying to figure out, well, okay, so how do we maintain profits? Well, if we move our manufacturing to Mexico, that reduces our transport costs. So that's actually starting to happen. The Mexican economy is also buoyed by the fact that it has large natural gas and petroleum deposits. So that has actually helped their economy quite a bit, especially during the recession.
Has the danger of the drug wars affected foreign investment into Mexico?
Yeah, it has in sort of fits and starts, just in bits and pieces, where a lot of U.S. companies, they haven't left Mexico, but they've reconsidered expanding their operations in Mexico. But they've also hired a lot of extra private security for their employees and also for their assets in Mexico. So that, in some respects, is a subsidiary economy, this private protection economy that's kind of popping up in different parts in Mexico.
Right. What about the tourism industry? Is that suffering?
You know, it has, especially around Acapulco. Acapulco has had significant increases in violence and in homicides, and that's largely because it's a retail market for drugs in Mexico. And that's really the thorny issue with Mexico, is it's a hybrid node in the global drug economy. It's a transit country for Colombian cocaine and some Colombian heroin. It's a source country for marijuana and Mexican heroin and also methamphetamine. But it's also a retail market for a lot of these drugs as well. So it's a consumer node of a smaller kind. So it's this hybrid type of country which breeds a lot more violence, because you have those features that are being fought over by gangs and by drug trafficking organizations.
Quite amazing. And what effect is it having on all the Mexican neighbors, so the United States and the other Latin American countries that border with Mexico? Are they suffering in any way, or are they even gaining in some manner from all this?
Yeah, the countries that are really suffering are actually in Central America, because they're also now becoming transit countries for drugs on their way to Mexico than on their way to the United States. So, for example, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras have homicide rates that are the highest in the region. And the only other two countries that have higher homicide rates than, say, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, one is Colombia, which has an active insurgency going on.
Yeah.
And the other one is Venezuela. Venezuela is, I think it's just below Colombia, or if not, on top of Colombia. And that's just because of the breakdown of law and order in the capital of Caracas. But El Salvador is permeated by a gang called Mara Salvatrucha Trece, which is MS-13, MS-18 as well. Guatemala has Caibiles. Caibiles are former members of their special forces that are colluding with Mexican drug traffickers on the other side of the border, from the shared border of Mexico and Guatemala. And Honduras as well is another country that has just a large gang issue and gang population. So a lot of those countries are suffering. And then on the United States side of the equation, we have increasing crime rates along portions of the border. And we also have had a sharp uptick in the number of homicides in Chicago. Now, Chicago is not on the border of Mexico, but what you have up there is a turf war, if you will, that is occurring on the streets as to who's going to control what retail markets in that city. And that's, a lot of it is related to Latin gangs and also drugs coming in from Mexico.
Well, so it's extended all the way to the Canadian border, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And we hear some things on the news, certainly over here, and other people around the world probably have heard about the Fast and Furious and the gun trade. how large is that gun trade? So this is the product that's returning across the border when the drugs are going across to the north.
Right. Yeah. There's sort of a mutually reinforcing dynamic where you have drugs coming from Mexico coming northbound, and you have money and guns going southbound. So it's this reinforcing cycle. Now, a lot of weapons are also coming from Central America. A lot of the really heavy weapons are left over from the civil wars in El Salvador and Guatemala during the Cold War. So you have a lot of, the 50 caliber machine guns and the, plastic explosives and mines and anti-tank weapons and such. Those are, a lot of that's coming from Central America.
Are they really using those? I mean, are they having fights in the street with 50 cals and anti-tank weapons?
Yeah, they will actually mount these on pickup trucks with their own logos on the side of the pickup trucks. I'm not sure of the precise number of Mexican helicopters from the Mexican military that have been that have actually been brought down. Nobody's been killed, fortunately, but a number of Mexican government helicopters have been brought down by these weapons. A lot of these groups actually will manufacture what are known as narco tanks. These are trucks and vehicles that are up armored that have turrets with 50 cals mounted on them, just to break through blockades that are set up by other gangs or other cartels or even the Mexican military.
It's just incredible. That sounds like the wars in Africa with the Honda, right. The technicals,
yeah,
driving around with the 50 cals on the back.
Yeah, and you can see it from across the border. You can see these groups going at it with one another. What's becoming a real worry is how, the younger members of these gangs are willing to take on U.S. Border Patrol and immigration folks more directly and more violently than they have in the past.
Mm, that's incredible. So what has been the government response to this in Mexico?
Well, the Mexican government's response during the Calderón years has been kind of twofold. One is reliance on the military for patrolling the streets in collaboration with some local law enforcement when they can find local law enforcement that isn't corrupt. And on the other side is judicial reform as well as law enforcement reform. So the Mexican legal system is based on the inquisitorial system. It's not based on the adversarial system. So you still have a very Napoleonic way of conducting trials where there's, the judge is also the investigator in many respects. So they're actually transitioning into a more adversarial type of legal system that, for example, we have in the United States. So we have a lot of partnerships here in the U.S. with Mexican judges and lawyers as they begin this transformation to a more evidence-based system, one that is not reliant on, say, confessions and just testimony. And the new president in Mexico is trying to organize a gendarmerie that's based on, say, the French or the Italian model.
Mm.
This is going to take some time. And there have always been a number of police reforms in Mexico, especially at the national level, as a way to backfill the military. So the hope is, okay, the military can get off the streets. They can get a more national police force that is less corrupt than, say, state police or municipal police. And that will be one of the ways that you can actually have a more legitimate government presence through a non-corrupt law enforcement agency of some kind. But it's going to take some time. And that's... a lot of Mexicans just don't have that time.
No, which is what you were talking about earlier with the breakdown and confidence in democracy and, I suppose, civil society.
Right, and especially when you have troops on the street, because soldiers are not trained to be police officers. So you have had an increase in the number of human rights complaints against the Mexican military, in particular the army. And that's just by virtue of, they're not trained to do it. They're also... in some respects, corrupted by the drug traffickers anyway, and are recruited by the drug traffickers, especially Los Zetas, who are, again, former military, so they know exactly the weaknesses that the Mexican military has, and especially the Mexican army, and will directly try to recruit individuals to come over to their side.
Mm. This sounds very similar to a conversation I had in another recording last year where it was an expert on Afghanistan, and he was saying they needed a similar policy of a gendarmerie rather than a military and civilian policing, because the civilian policing process that would come from, say, a United States city or an Australian city, a British city, was inadequate. And the military was far too strong. Needed that middle road.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's basically what we have, is we have two organizations that deal with collective violence, right? One is the military, which is really designed to kill people and break things, and a police force, which you really hope doesn't do that. You know, you don't want a police force that kills people and breaks things. Citizens have a very low threshold for collateral damage when it comes to policing. But between those two is really the gap or the seam where these cartels and gangs operate, because they have such a high level of violence. Their willingness to use violence at a very high level, but they're also criminals. So where, you know, who takes over? Is it the military or the police, right? The military that is too strong to really work hand in hand with a community that's affected, or a police force that is outgunned by criminals who are, in fact, former members of the military.
Yeah, astounding problems. I teach a policy subject here, and we call these wicked problems. There's just no easy solution to them.
Right, yeah, they're sort of, you know, the least worst solution.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So no one's going to be happy, but it's about how less unhappy you will be rather than happy.
Yeah. Right,
yeah. What about from the United States' point of view? What's the United States been doing?
Well, the U.S. has, again, been trying to work with the Mexican government in police reforms, judicial reforms. There's also the Merida Initiative, which is a substantial aid package that is helping to train Mexican law enforcement and transform the legal system. There's also been greater cooperation across the border between the Mexican military and U.S. military. But there's also kind of a history of mistrust on both sides that is a product of our shared history. For example, Mexicans still harbor some ill will towards the United States because the United States had seized a lot of their territory over the years. And so they're always worried about sovereignty issues.
I'll just point out that's nearly 200 years old, that grievance.
Right. Yeah, this is true, but you know, it's still part of the culture of the history of Mexicans. In fact, their National Military Academy celebrates several cadets who fought the Americans as they tried to prevent them from taking the Mexican flag down when they conquered Mexican territory and annexed it to the United States. So it's still part of that institutional memory, even of the Mexican armed forces. And then on the other side of the equation, the United States is awfully mistrustful of sharing too much intelligence or information with Mexican counterparts because they're worried about corruption. If we give you any intelligence, this is really just going to end up in the hands of the cartels and gangs, or you're going to tip them off anyway. So there's a lot of work to be done in overcoming that sort of mutual mistrust between the two sides.
Right. Now, I'd like to move on and spend a fair bit of time on your recommendations on what should be done. They're quite detailed and I thought very positive, really, given the circumstances. So we're still talking about a wicked problem, but you try and bring things into a perspective, especially in relation to this is not a counterinsurgency. You're trying to differentiate between anti-terrorist activity as opposed to the situation in Mexico.
Right, and that's for me, that's one of the most important points of the book, is that even though the levels of violence are very high and mimic things like insurgency or terrorism, it's not low-intensity conflict. I call it high-intensity crime. It's actually a label I borrow from post-Cold War literature. But it's high-intensity crime, so you have to look at the motivations for the violence rather than, okay, the violence itself has similarities between, you know, terrorism and insurgency. So looking at motivations and looking at causes gives you a better idea of how to frame solutions, or at least approaches to solutions. Because as soon as you say insurgency or terrorism, you immediately then begin to look at counterinsurgency and counterterrorism, which again, you know, if we're talking about counter-narcotics, you know, counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, counter-narcotics are not the same thing. Just because they share a common prefix doesn't mean they can be employed towards a common end, that you can actually undermine one by using the other. So counterinsurgency, you can do winning hearts and minds. That's one way. Another part of counterinsurgency is a really heavy-handed, enemy-centric approach that we saw in places like Sri Lanka or even Russia in the case of Chechnya. So that you probably don't want to do in a situation like Mexico. And counterterrorism, of course, you go into things like preemption and prevention and some abuses of civil liberties and civil rights. And that's probably also not the right way to go when it comes to dealing with what is criminal activity. I mean, again, very bad criminal activity, but at the same time, the guiding star has to be civil rights and civil liberties as a way to begin to build legitimacy and then figure out ways to reduce violence over time.
Right, right. So do you want to just run through what you think are the key recommendations that you would make in dealing with the problem?
Yeah, sure. If it's high-intensity crime, what I recommend is high-intensity law enforcement, which isn't to say that you need to turn Mexico into a police state or you need to flood Mexico with police officers. What several studies have suggested is that Mexico has a large number of police. However, a lot of them at the municipal level are corrupt, or there are areas and towns that have no police coverage at all. So what needs to be done is actually to train this national gendarmerie and also to have certain parts of the Mexican military train with this gendarmerie, much as the Italian army and Italian carabinieri train together at an academy to do police work and to figure out which are the most violent cartels and to go after who they are and where they operate, rather than going after all six or seven cartels simultaneously over all areas of Mexico. So you could have, for example, what I call a Zeta first strategy, which is to go after the most violent cartel, which is Los Zetas, the one that is the most proficient in the use of violence, the one that is most dangerous for the Mexican state. So in essence, pick a side, which is what the Colombians did in the 1990s. They said, okay, Pablo Escobar, the Medellin cartel, most vicious, most violent, most challenging of the state, we're going to pick them to go after first. We're going to leave some of the other cartels alone for a little bit, and they'll feed us information and intelligence anyway because they're trying to eliminate a market competitor. So I think if you pick the Zetas first, you can begin to reduce some of the violence in some areas of Mexico because you're eliminating a competitor. Another idea is to actually focus geographically on certain key areas, especially along the northern part of Mexico, those northern states, and focus on how to bring some security to the citizenry there. So rather than looking at a blanket strategy of covering all of Mexico, focus on some of the more violent areas in northern Mexico. So those are some of the approaches that I recommend toward the end of the book. There's been a lot of discussion about, say, what drug legalization would do in a way to kind of suck out the oxygen from these groups, but that's a difficult argument in a lot of respects, because what you would do, let's say, you know, we were to legalize drugs here in the United States overnight or pick a deadline of some kind, what would happen is a lot of gang members, a lot of cartel members would be immediately thrown out of work. So now you have sort of unemployed people who are very proficient in the use of violence, and they would simply move on to another industry or another set of activities, extortion, trafficking, smuggling of counterfeits, CDs, et cetera. So it wouldn't necessarily solve the problem immediately. It would just cause a labor force to move out of a particular market and seek out new avenues. And again, if their expertise is violence and smuggling, that's what they're going to rely on
And the US is still going to be a very large marketplace that they need to smuggle goods into, wherever these particular contraband goods are.
Right. And this is, you know, somewhat akin, although not exactly the same, as what happened with the fall of the Soviet Union. You had, you know, a lot of KGB, secret police, all of a sudden they're out of work. It's like, well, what do I do? I'm actually pretty good at, you know, the gun and violence and shaking people down. So they get hired by the Russian mafia.
Mm. So
immediately in the Yeltsin years, you have very similar rates of violence and types of violence occurring in Russia that you have in Mexico. So there are sort of prevailing conditions that happen that bring about these, you know, these episodes of high intensity crime.
Right. One of the interesting things, one of my other guests I've spoken to about, is with the continuing rise in the price of tobacco through tobacco taxing as a policy to reduce smoking in places like Australia, United States, and in Europe. Tobacco is becoming a smuggling product of choice because the penal consequences are very low. The likelihood of going to jail is extremely low, and the profits are becoming higher and higher. Has tobacco started to appear in the mix?
You know, it's actually appeared on our northern border with Canada.
Right.
For precisely the reason you talk about, which is tobacco, cigarette taxes in Canada are much higher than they are in the United States. So you have that incentive to smuggle north of the border with you know, tobacco and cigarettes. And what's interesting is we have a couple of Native American Indian reservations that border Canada. And as part of the arrangement with the United States government, they do not tax cigarettes at all in the U.S. So there are non-taxed, even cheaper cigarettes on these Indian reservations that can be smuggled into Canada at an even lower price. So there's a greater incentive. So we've actually had some violent episodes across the northern border because of cigarette smuggling. Again, for the precise reasons that you talk about, that it's, you know, it's just at such a higher rate of taxation. There's such a higher rate of taxation in Canada as compared to the United States.
So I suppose to wrap up, I'm going to ask you to be produce some predictions of the future. Where do you see this whole situation being in about 10 years' time?
Ah, boy. I think what we'll see in Mexico is you'll probably have a return to the old regime, which is a lot of the political elite will figure out, okay, which trafficking group is, or which trafficking groups are the best ones to actually have a partnership with. And if they can guarantee a certain level of stability, a reduction in violence, then everything will be fine. So it's one of those things where, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. The deal is, you know, take the killing somewhere else, don't be so violent, and we'll let you traffic the drugs up to the gringos in the north. So I think what we will see in the future is a reduction in the number of big cartels. So we probably won't have six or seven. We'll probably have about three. So there'll be a balance of power of some sort amongst the cartels themselves, then a return to the collusion by the Mexican government. Rates of violence will be reduced. And largely, each side can claim some sort of success, if you will. There'll probably be, you know, spikes and dips in the violence. It'll be kind of the new normal, if you will, where the horrific spikes in violence all of a sudden, then there'll be kind of a, hey, everybody calm down. Here's what the arrangement is. That'll return to a certain basic level that's acceptable to everybody. But I think that's where the situation is going, because this sort of level of violence can't be sustained over such a long period of time without deals being made and without eliminations happening, without a cartel or two just self-eliminating because they're just pushed against the wall. They've angered too many cartels. They've angered the government. And so there's the kind of pylon effect that occurs.
Well, it's not a thrilling outcome for everybody. It's hardly positive, but history would prove you're right.
It's the least worst outcome. Because we're not going to legalize drugs here in the U.S. We may legalize marijuana, but we're not going to legalize things like methamphetamine, cocaine, or heroin. So there'll still be those markets. And also prescription medications are also hugely trafficked between our two countries as well. So there's that market, trafficking of human beings. So the least worst outcome is, okay, a reduction in violence. And sad to say, people who are getting high, they're always going to get high. So they're always going to find a way to get drugs, especially from Mexico.
Yep. I've done an exercise in our tutorials with the students every year of, if you wanted to legalize drugs, what would you legalize? And they start by saying everything. And by the time the conversation's over, they end up with just decriminalizing marijuana, because the consequences, when you think about it, you don't want five-year-old children smoking PCP. So you have to start scaling things back. So realistically, the legalization option is just not going to happen.
Yeah, and it depends on, you know, I've had this discussion as well amongst various audiences when I said, what about legalizing drugs? And I said, well, first of all, you need to be clear on two things. One is, when you say drugs, what do you mean? You mean marijuana all the way through to methamphetamine, because those are very different drugs. And by legalization, do you mean commercialization? Do you mean the same thing that we do with cigarettes and alcohol? So companies can get involved. And I said, companies are not in the business of getting their product into as few hands as possible. They want their product in as many hands as possible. So do you want that to occur? You know, do you want coupons for methamphetamine found in your Glamour magazine? You know, sort of, what do you envision it to look like? Right, which is sort of the exercise it sounds like you do with you.
Yes, yeah, very similar. Yeah, I hadn't quite gone that far. That's good. I'll include that in future with your permission.
Yeah, but it's sort of, you know, what does this drug utopia look like? And, you know, Portugal has had some success with decriminalization, but that's decriminalization of use, not necessarily trafficking and production. So that's, you know, those are the sort of the open questions I have for those folks who want to legalize. I say, okay, well, what are we talking about here? And who do you want living next door to you? You know, do you want to, and that may give you some indication of when you think about drugs, what do you define it? You know, it's sort of, okay, you want to have your next door neighbor who's a drunk, you know, a weed head, a meth freak, you know, who do you want? Tell you, oh, okay, maybe I don't want to have a meth freak next door who's hallucinating and what have you. Yeah, it's a difficult subject, and you know, like I said, I think there's always going to be some control over intoxicants, just by, as you mentioned, just for public safety and public health.
Which means there will always be a black market, which means there's an opportunity, a business opportunity for the cartels.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, just a final question. Would you like to discuss what you're working on now? What's your next project?
You know, I'm actually working on two things. One is related to the topics I've worked on for a few years now. So I'm looking at radical organized crime, which would be like what we've been talking about here, organized crime that is much more confrontational towards the state, that is wanton in their use of violence, and that is aggressively expansionist into new markets, because a lot of organized crime is not that way. Generally, organized crime is much more peaceful, co-opting of the state, and will expand in bits and pieces, but not aggressively so into other areas. So that's one area I'm looking at. And then another area I'm looking at is totally off in some respects. I call them ideologically motivated cyber groups. So groups like Anonymous, hacktivists, and trying to do a genus and species typology of them. So rather than just saying, okay, they're all hackers or they're all hacktivists, but it's to try to delineate, okay, well, they're the hacktivists who actually have a political motivation in the physical world and will go online to try to enlist others, versus groups like Anonymous who actually have an ideology that is somewhat akin to saying, you know, human liberation begins with the liberation of information. So you have to have the free flow of information in order for humans to be truly free. And a lot of their activity is online rather than in the physical world. So I call it hacktivists, slacktivists, and wiki warriors. And that's kind of where I'm heading right now.
Well, that sounds really, really interesting, actually. So, well, keep me informed of when your next publications come out, and we can discuss those as well. Well, thank you very, very much for giving me your time today, Paul. I really appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure, Mark. Thanks very much.
You have been listening to New Books in Terrorism and Organized Crime and my interview with Paul Rexton Khan about his new book, Cartels at War. I hope you enjoyed the program.